Hey, everyone. If managing your business financials is kind of making your hair gray, you don't want to miss this web class April 8th featuring the one and only Matt Reisinger. Matt and I are going to be teaming up to teach you the least painful way to track your budgets, do proper forecasting, and monitor overhead using our foolproof templates. What good margins actually look like in your industry so you can take out the guesswork and have something to benchmark yourself against. And lessons learned from Matt on his way to becoming an industry titan. If you know that now is the time to start making changes, but the thought of it kind of makes you nauseous, this web class is for you. April 8th, register in the link in the description, and I'll see you there.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. Ellen Rohr is an industry legend. She's built and sold two companies, written a slew of unbelievably helpful books, including Where Did the Money Go? And How Much Should I Charge? Which we're going to talk about today. She's the founder and owner of Zoom Drain, which now has over 50 locations. This woman is incredible, and we are unbelievably lucky to have her as a guest. Our conversation, though, today is focused on pricing. In other words, how much should you charge and why? Some highlights include why price is the easiest and first lever you should always pull when you're trying to grow your top or bottom line. How to use psychology to help you or your sales team gain the confidence needed to own your value and charge what you need to charge. And lastly, we cover a simple equation for calculating your own selling price based on your unique financial goals. And guess what? What your competition is charging has nothing to do with it. By the way, when she goes through the selling price math equation, she references a budgeting tool. If you want a template for that, you can download it using the link in the description. You go to the second tab in the spreadsheet to find it. Okay, without further ado, let's dive in with Ellen Rohr. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. The great and powerful Ellen Rohr is here. Ellen, how are you?
I'm behind the curtain. Here I am. Hi, Benji. I love you. I've loved so much getting to know you and getting ready for this podcast. It's going to be a good one.
Thank you. And so are we. We've been looking forward to this all week. In 2011, this is the right place to begin this conversation, I think. In 2011, you wrote a book called What Should I Charge? And that's just a very good way to title a book, because that's a question that a lot of people have. And I wonder if you can go back to that time, the context you were in, what you were hearing from people that you worked with, problems that you were seeing maybe in the space. Like what drove you to write that book and kind of create this framework?
I wouldn't have written the book, How Much Should I Charge? If you're looking for it, How Much Should I Charge? If I didn't need that book, because I didn't know how to do it. When I went to school, I went to the University of San Diego in California. I graduated at the top of my class. I thought it was all that. In college, I learned things like what the market will bear and the going rate. And I thought that's what you needed to set your selling prices. And then I married my husband, Hot Rod, the plumber. And with a name like that,
how could you not?
Yeah, he was a stunt car driver and a plumber, so sexy all around. And so I married him, and he had a partner, and he and his partner had a company called Hot Rod and Yachts. That was the other fellow's name, very cleverly called Hot Rod and Yachts Plumbing, Heating, and Solar in Park City, Utah. So I married Hot Rod, and I thought being a plumber was a selling feature. I thought plumbers made a lot of money. I didn't know anything about the trades. My dad wasn't handy. And I had my own career. I've had about 1 million jobs. I've had a lot of restaurant jobs, and that was really the career arc I was in. And Hot Rod's partner, Yox, a fellow named Richard Yox, we called him Yox, they'd been friends since they were kids. And they grew up together, and they opened this business together. And Hot Rod is very laid back. Yox, not so much. So Yox is a worrier, type A. He said, on a Friday afternoon after he was just stressed out, worked about 100 hours a week, he said to me, if I don't do it myself, it'll never get done. And I'm like, it'll be fine. He ended up not feeling well, going to the hospital. And on Sunday of that week, at age 33, Yox died. So here's a young man, my husband's best friend, who literally worked himself into a stress-induced health crisis at 33 years old, worrying about everything. And I tell this story a lot, Benji, because so many of us are sacrificing our health, our relationships for this business. And it doesn't have to be that way. It shouldn't be that way. Mm-hmm. But this is what really kicked off me getting in the business. So then I turned to Hot Rod after like the dust settles and the grief subsides. And I said, well, you know what? I will go into business with you. I'll quit my real job. I'll take over. Yachts used to do the accounting. I'll do the money. You turn the wrenches. We'll get rich. Like a lot of mom pop shops start with that basic idea, right? Well, it was awful. We didn't make any money. Now we don't have my salary. We're going into debt so fast. I'm absolutely hating it. I look at the financials and I don't know what to make of them. They're a mess. What I learned in school didn't teach me how to fix messy financials. I couldn't make sense of any of it. I was resentful. We're broke and we're fighting. Now, maybe some of your listeners are relating to this. This is not an uncommon story. And so what happened is I ended up reading an article in a trade magazine. I mean, 40 years ago, we didn't have podcasts. Now I listen to podcasts. Once upon a time, all we had was trade magazines, and we still do, and they're great resources. Smart people tell you how they did it. Mm. And there was an article in Plumbing and Mechanical magazine by a fellow named Frank Blau, who's still alive and almost 100 years old now. And Frank wrote this article called How Much Should a Contractor Charge? And I read this article, and this is the basic math. He says, forget what the market will bear or the going rate. What do these knuckleheads know? Instead, add up all your costs of doing business and charge more than that. So all your costs of doing business, maybe divide it by the number of billable hours you might have. We can get into this a little more in the upcoming minutes, Benji. And then inflate that for profit. That's how you come up with a selling price. So I wrote this guy a letter. I read your article. Dear Mr. Blau, please help me. My husband and I hate each other and we're broke. I read your column. However, everything you say is wrong. This is how I wrote this letter, and this is how knuckleheaded I am. Then I proceed to tell him about the going rate and what the market will bear, and you don't understand my cheap customers and my troublemaking employees and blah, blah, blah. 2 pages of solid whining. I send off this letter. So pretty much I make a reach for help, but then, you know, none of what you're about to say or just said in this article is going to work anyway. So he calls me up. I get a call from this guy. I answer the phone, and the first thing he says to me is, honey, you have your head so far, and he tells me where my head is. And I'm like totally insulted. Who is this? What is this? Is Frank Blau. You sent me this stupid letter. I get a lot of letters. This is the stupidest letter. Shut your business down, he says. There's no hope for you. You think you know everything. You got a college degree. He's just like beating me up. And I hang up on him. I'm just like, I'm not taking this. I get off the phone. Then I'm talking to Hot Rod about it. And Hot Rod's like, I think you need to call him back. I'm like, I don't want to. But I did. And the next day, I call him back, laid low, humbled, tears in my eyes, like, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing. And if you would be so kind as to steer me in the right direction. And he did. Me and so many others. Like, you talk to all the OGs in our industry, and they're going to have heard of Frank Blau. Frank did so much good for the industry. But what he taught me was the basic selling price formula. And it doesn't matter what your contractor friends are charging.
So we will get into this formula in a minute, but I think there's a couple other like preamble questions I have for you. One is just sort of why you're so passionate about pricing. And I'll maybe preface it by saying, for me, my understanding of this, not just theoretically, but in actual sort of like first world experience is, and you'll hear this said by way smarter people than me with way bigger followings all the time. Dan Martell is one of them. Alex Hormozy talks about this a lot. If you're, an older in the marketing space, Frank Kern talks about this a lot. They'll phrase it different ways, but it's basically the idea is price is the easiest lever to pull if you are trying to grow your business. There's lots of levers. If you're just looking for the one that is the easiest to pull, it's price. If you're looking for the loosest Jenga block in the Jenga tower to tap, you focus on price first. We had a really, really amazing private equity CEO on a few weeks ago named Adam Coffey, and he talks a lot about price sensitivity and the actual math required to figure out that optimal pricing mix. And he literally does nothing else in a business until they figure out price first. I asked you a question that I shared my opinion. Got to stop doing that.
That's all right. All of that. Yes.
Why are you so passionate about pricing as a tool in a business?
All that you said is so spot on. And unless you're priced right, none of those other levers are going to matter.
Right.
So it's that important. And so when I took the medicine once upon a time, that's how Frank described it. Like he said, you're going to have to raise your prices. No, I can't. Finally, I thought, I don't want to be broke anymore. Maybe this won't work. I'm going to raise my prices. And you know what? If I go out of business, I am fine with that. I'm fine with that. I said to Hot Rod, do you want to do this? He's like, not very much. I said, well, if we're going to do it, let's try this. Let's raise our prices. And, back in the day, this is going back to like 1991, we quintupled our prices.
Wow.
Went from $30 an hour to $150 an hour. Now, by today's standards, that's peanuts. But that was the going rate, $30 an hour. And so we did take this risk of standing out, like by all other logical financial reasoning, we should have gone out of business for being overpriced. The reality is that price is not the most important thing to your customers. Like, okay, I just did, just to kind of segue here, I just did a bathroom remodel with my husband, the plumber. But we needed a sheetrocker and a painter and a tile guy and a glass guy and a countertop guy. I didn't Google any of them. I asked the first guy who was a recommendation from a friend of mine, the tile guy, who do you know who's a glass guy? And then the glass guy told me about the counter guy. Like, it is your reputation. It is that relationship development that will sink or swim your business. Now, you can use social media to enhance that. You can do all sorts of automated marketing. You can do digital marketing. But being a good contractor is essential. And charging the right price to be able to do that, to provide good benefits and pay to your team members, nice trucks, good tools, sound uniforms, functional spaces, all of that is going to cost your customer, but ultimately your customer wants to find their guy. And they don't know how much it should. I don't know how much all those things should cost. And I'm in the biz. I don't know.
How do most contractors do it? We mentioned a few ideas on the intro there about what the ideas like what the market will bear, or I charge what my competitors charge. Can we elaborate on sort of the typical flawed, but the typical approach to building a pricing strategy that a contractor might follow?
Well, I'm laughing because I used to call my competitors and ask how much they'd charge, but for some reason I would use a terrible British accent to do it. So, yeah, I don't know
where that
came from.
You're paranoid.
Yeah, I don't know. And then I'd ask a really specific question like, how much for a Bradford White X533 40-gallon gas? Like something a homeowner would never ask or know. So that's how I did it once upon a time. But picture this too. I'm also a huge fan of once you figure out the price, as you figure out the price, share this math with your team. It's called open book management. Back in the day, I didn't know there was a name for it, but open book management is sharing real and relevant financial information with your team members. A great book on that is called The Great Game of Business by Jack Stack, a classic. Mm-hmm. Taught me a lot. Love him. So what can happen if you don't do that is suppose you do raise your prices. You find someone like Frank Blau or me who just like gives you the business and you raise your prices. Unless you get your team in on the game, they may not understand all the costs that go into that selling price. And so they might think, okay, he's paying me $30 an hour and he's charging $400 an hour. It's a lot of money, man. He is raking it in. And if that person leaves, maybe there's nowhere to grow. Maybe there's not great leadership. Maybe this guy's got an entrepreneurial seizure or has an entrepreneurial seizure, like Michael Gerber says, and he goes out on his own. That uneducated person is now the one who is, okay, I pay myself $30 an hour and probably another $100 an hour would cover it. So they're guessing and they're keeping that bar low. Another really important element here is that Frank told me that the problem in our industry is a pricing problem, yes, but the pricing problem is born from a lack of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have plastic surgeons at the convention going, that guy's ripping someone off. He's charging $25,000 for a nose job.
You also don't have plastic surgeons at the convention trying to compete on price, being like, yeah, we're the cheapest, come to our booth, we'll get you a discount.
100%. Like, they, and so what's the difference? Is that a plastic surgeon understands his worth. Mm. However, when we look at the worth to society of a plastic surgeon, it's high. But let's look at what a drain cleaner does for society.
Say more about
keeping people safe from disease, yeah, making sure that good water stays away from bad water, preventing more disease than doctors will ever cure. But if you go home, one of the things I say, one of the things I say to our drain cleaning team members when they first come on board, welcome aboard. Did you tell your mom yet that you're going to work at a drain cleaning company? Yes. Was she excited about it? No. Okay, well, here's some stuff to tell your mom. 70% of the world has inadequate sanitation. 30% of the world poops on the ground. Mm. And those people die of those sewage-borne diseases that you prevent. Your work is essential. During the pandemic, we went to work. We kept people safe. When other industries shut down, you have a bright career here. We're going to train you on the job in our classrooms, pay you to do it so that you can be a drain professional anywhere in the world. But all of that has to be tied into those selling price calculations. When I would work with companies and I'd help them, you know, do the math and figure out their selling price, I would say, okay, I'm now giving you a loaded gun, because unless you become operationally better, unless your communication skills improve, unless you learn some sales, ethical sales techniques that are going to help you communicate the value of your services, that price may cause a customer to go, wow, he's just three times, five times what the other guys are. I'm going to go with the other guy. So part of raising your prices is learning how to communicate the value of your services.
Well, that's a really interesting I'm glad you brought that up. I don't want this conversation to come across as a very surface level, jack up your prices because we said so bit. Like, there's a very important conceptual distinction between value and price, right? And so you need to understand both. And this whole pricing exercise, and we'll get into the math in a second, is not going to last very long if we're moving up one without moving up the other.
Yeah.
People think their customers are dumber than they are. And it doesn't take long for people to figure out that the difference between this guy is jacking up his prices because he listened to a podcast where he was told to do that. This guy has an expensive price because he delivers a ton of value. And I can see that value in the uniforms that people wear when they show up, the eye contact that the tech makes with me, and the overall sense of comfort that I get from the people that I've interacted with, how quickly they get back to me when I call, the service they provide, the brand that they operate under, the insurance that they use to, you know, protect themselves and protect me, blah, 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 blah. Like that, I'm making the case that if you do one without the other, it's a very, very, very short-term strategy. So please, for heaven's sake, as we get into this conversation, which ultimately is going to lead to the conclusion, you should probably aim to move your prices up. Don't do that on an island. Don't do that in, you know, without also bringing the value up as well and communicating it.
Well, that brought up a couple things in my head as you were talking. One is I learned this from the great Harry Friedman, an amazing sales trainer and operational master. He said that when price exceeds value, there's no sale. And so when you come to someone's house and they're looking at, well, I can clear your drain and it's going to cost this much, unless the value is established, the price is always too high. And if you don't know how to communicate well, the easiest thing to do is to shrink the price so the value appears bigger. And that's the uneducated contractor's way to make a sale. Instead, if you kept layering on the value and it's all those things you just mentioned, like I like it when a contractor shows up at my house and I go, this is going to cost me. I just know it because of the way his truck looks, you know, but it's okay. It's going to he's going to be premium. Let's see if he lives up to it. Yeah. Right. But he's setting the stage that, you know, they know where he is. He's parked in the street. He looks nice. He's clean, sober, on time, dressed right. He's using a checklist. All of those things, like as a homeowner, and there are a lot of people like me, those things are more important than the price. Is he on time? Benjamin Franklin, the punctual plumber, the only thing they promise is they'll be on time, and that's what allows them to charge a premium price. So, so one, you've got to earn it. But here's the other thing I want to mention. By virtue of listening to this podcast, you care about your customers, your people, and your business. You're trying to improve your state. You're already better than your prices may reflect. So you could raise your prices right now. I'll tell you, when we raised our prices, the one thing we did, I'm going to make you laugh with this one, Benji. The one thing we did is I got the guys shirts. Up until then, they wore any shirts that they wanted, and they were usually a mess. One of my guys wore a shirt that said, kill them all, let God sort them out to work. So we got
that's shirts unreal. That guy that is so
hot
metal.
Rod and yawks on them that look nice. Like, so, you know, I think it's also don't be afraid to raise your prices to afford to buy nicer shirts and trucks and tools. Where else is the money going to come from? So there is a balance. Be committed to plowing that money back into the business to make good on the promises that you're making with these higher prices.
It's so well said. Can you walk? So let's do a walkthrough, if you will, of the math, of the framework that you talk about in the book, you talk about from stage. And my hope is that like along the way, there's some really interesting insights that we can share. And as well, as much as possible, maybe we can make this very much like a first principles, like almost like white labeled version of pricing. Because there's builders, there's landscapers, there's roofers, there's pool guys listening to this podcast. But and while certain elements of it are going to be a little bit different, I do think the fundamentals are a little more universal. So take
us through
it.
I've got an exercise for you.
Sure.
Okay. So overall, the basic formula for coming up with a selling price, the math that I put in my book, how much should I charge? What Frank Blau taught me is this: make a list of your costs of doing business. It's a budget, really. And you would put in labor for your technicians, labor salary for the owners, advertising, insurance, lease, rent, you know, the whole lineup. You'll find that list on your profit and loss, right? So you're going to add up all those costs of doing business, and then you're going to inflate those costs for what they should be. How about raises for the guys? Now, all of this is in the world of pretend. You don't even have to do this yet, but try this exercise. How much would you like to pay your guys? How much would you like to make? How much do you want to pay your wife who's working for free right now? You know, what do we want for uniforms and insurance and benefits and on down the list? So you're going to make an ideal list of expenses for labor and overhead. So you've got that total number. Then you're going to look at the number of technicians you have. And let's say we could use about 1,000 hours a year for the billable hours per technician. And this is how I come up with that. So let's say you have 52 weeks in the year. And to make the math easy and to give somebody a vacation, let's make it 50 weeks a year. Mm-hmm. So 50 weeks a year times 40 hours a week is 2,000. 50 weeks, 40 hours, 2,000 hours a week available that you're paying your team. And let's just assume no overtime. Do we really want to pay overtime? Do we want to work overtime? Just like, again, let's be conservative here. So we have 2,000 hours. And based on my over 40 years of experience in a service business of any stripe where we're knocking on doors, to get 1,000 billable hours out of a service technician is great, is a very high standard, but it also makes the math easy. Mm. All right, so now we have 1,000 billable hours. Then you're going to divide that into your total costs of doing business, and you'll get a break even per billable hour and inflate that for profit. Now that becomes an effective labor rate. However, I suggest you don't charge time and material, put together a little menu. And this is, I love ServiceTitan. It's got a price book built into it. Your CRM may. I did a handwritten price book once upon a time with 10 tasks on it. You can buy them, you can make one, but create a menu price. We know about how long it takes to put in a water heater or a gutter or irrigation. And, you know, it's like a bid job. We're going to create bid jobs for our basic tasks. Is this making sense
totally,
so far?
Totally, 100%. I'm tracking.
Okay, so that's how you do it. But here's the little exercise. Okay, so this is how it gets high. The price gets high. The difference between a high-priced contractor and a low-priced contractor is what they give the people at the company. So, I mean, gas is the same for everyone. Fuel is the same for everyone. Insurance is about the same. Materials are about the same. So the big difference is, what are we providing for the people in terms of salary, benefits, and nice things? So when you get real with that, that's where the self-esteem comes in. What do you think you and your team are worth? This is how you do this exercise a couple of ways. Like, do a conservative one, get a little more generous with yourself and your team and so on, and play with this formula. So let's do it this way. Here's an easy way to do it. So we have this 1,000 billable hours. Let's just take one of those expenses. Say you work all by yourself. And how much do you want to make this year? How much do you want to make in gross wages this year? They're going to take taxes out, so inflate it. Is $100,000 too much? Is $200,000 too much? Is $300,000 reasonable for the blood, sweat, and tears you're going to put into this, the availability that you need to provide, the skill set, the aches and pains on your body? Like, what number's too big? I don't know a number that's too big. But let's say it's $300,000.
Okay.
If you work all by yourself, just to make the math easy, and you can follow as you're listening or driving, you make $300,000. You want to make $300,000 a year. And you're working, charging the customer for 1,000 hours. Your price needs to include $300 per hour just for that salary. Which brings up another interesting point, Benji. When someone says, I'm a small shop, I don't have to charge as much as a big shop, the small shops don't have as many billable hours. You can actually charge less as a big shop because you're going to have more guys, more techs, more billable hours. You get some economies of scale if you're running 10 trucks out of an outfit instead of 3 trucks out of a location. You see where I'm going?
100%.
So the tricky thing is, man, this exercise made me almost poop my pants. I'm just saying, when Frank Blau was talking me through this, I can still get this visceral reaction of how I was using a 10 key and a green columnar pad to do it because we didn't have spreadsheets back then. And as I'm adding this up, my stomach is hurting.
You like, just couldn't believe how big the number was getting?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so you end up toning it down, and that's fine. Like, I'm not going to make you do anything. I'm not going to use words like should or whatever. I'm just going to say could or would or maybe. Explore this, because this is what changed my life. You asked earlier why I'm so passionate about it. It's like being born again for me. Like, it's like this changed everything for me. Mm-hmm. Is understanding how to charge more than it costs and then figuring out, okay, then we have to be operationally better. But generally, you already are. You already are. You're doing good things out there. In this equation, the customer often gets the better deal, and that you're the one holding the short straw has been my experience over and over again with contractors. I love an opportunity like this, Benji, because I'm a champion of contractors, keeping good water from bad water, wrangling electricity, creating weather. That's what HVAC guys do. Isn't that amazing?
Totally.
I don't know how to do those things. So I'll pay for them. And I just want you to show up clean, sober, on time, dressed right, use a checklist, and be my guy.
There's a heavy emphasis on this idea of billable hours in sort of the quick math that you ran through there, which I wanna key in on for a couple reasons. One thing is, I mean, I know nobody loves lawyers necessarily, but one thing that they do and professional services like them do really well is they make sure as many hours of their team are billable versus non-billable. Like, that's, if you were leading a law firm, there would be systems and strategies in place to ensure as little time of your lawyer's team is spent non-billable, because that's, then you're just paying for that out of overhead. So can you maybe comment on, maybe expand on this idea of like why billable hours is such an important thing to really get laser focused on in this whole mix? Because you, like, along the way when you're doing the math, you could get distracted by a bunch of things. You could get caught up on, well, the cost of my rent may go up next year, or I'm not really sure if I can get this material that I'm passing through to my customer. Like, you can, there's lots of distractions, and I like frameworks where I sort of, we're able to give people blinders and just like focus on this one thing. So, and billable hours sort of rises to the top or seems like something that's in bright neon lights. Talk a little bit more about it and sort of how it fits in.
You're such a good interviewer because you're catching the things that matter. And I'm like, oh, good. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I would be thinking about it at 2 a.m. this next morning. Oh, we didn't add that nuance. Because here's the thing about services. Is they are delivered via the widget of time.
Correct.
So if you made t-shirts, this formula is the same, but you could massage the number of t-shirts that you make. You could have them made offshore. You could change the quality of the t-shirts. You would do the same math. What's my cost per t-shirt? If you want Shark Tank, that's what they're asking. What's your cost per unit, right? That's still a valid mathematical exercise. In our world, what we sell is time, because you need someone to put it in. If someone just wanted a water heater, they can get one at the supply house or at Home Depot. Now, when I was back working with Hot Rod, they didn't have these things. You had to buy a toilet from a plumber. Isn't that crazy? There was no Menards or Home Depot or Lowe's. Right. I remember when the first ones opened, and I'm like, that's going to change things. But really, it wasn't the demise of the industry, because people still want you to do it. And that's the widget. So in our calculations, the widget that we're selling is time. But let's look at what happens with material. Now, as a drain cleaning professional, that's what we do at Zoom Drain, we don't have a lot of materials.
Right.
So we have to charge enough in our menu pricing to cover that labor hour, which according to our calculations is going to cover the team member who's doing the work, and then everybody else and all other expenses and overhead. So labor and overhead plus profit is how we build our selling price. If you do sell materials, materials are great, because materials allow you to leverage the labor hour. If you sell a nice boiler versus a piece of crap boiler, the customer wins because it's a nicer product, but you also win because this is so counterintuitive to our industry. The more expensive the boiler is, the more money you make. And the customer gets a nice, assuming that the expensive boiler is a better piece of equipment, everybody wins. Mm-hmm. But if you mark that boiler up just for profit, the more expensive the boiler is, the more profit you can make in the same number of labor hours. So that's why material can really help you. If you have the opportunity to sell material with your labor hour, that's great. See, doesn't this come back to the self-esteem? Because I can almost hear someone saying, yeah, but you wouldn't want the customer to... The customer's fine.
Yeah.
Let them say yes or no, but let's not leave you out of the equation.
There are pros and cons to every business, I understand, but one, like I've always said this, like I would never be really interested in a business where there wasn't quite a bit of material I could pass through, mark up. Like, it's just like, you know, the idea of... No offense to my window cleaning listeners. You guys are great.
But or drain cleaning guests.
Whatever. The idea of like just having labor and like squeegees and water, like forget it. I want lumber. Mm-hmm. I want shingles. I want paint. I want landscaping supplies. Something that you can take from a supplier, mark up by whatever percent and pass through. Means you need to get heavier equipment and some trucks to move that stuff around. But from a business standpoint, that is a nice thing to have for whatever that's worth, the materials in the middle.
You know what? That's very good counsel. And that's, you know, if you're looking to get into the trades, it's something to consider.
It is.
Is there a way to leverage those labor hours with the sale of materials?
Do you have an opinion on where people should be in the market? Like, for example, like, is it a good rule of thumb to always be in the top third or the top quarter? Or is it like, don't pay attention to the broader market at all and just do your own math and figure out what that price is?
Okay, so when you listen to this, it's going to depend a lot on your own personality. You know, like personality mapping, have you done stuff like this?
Mm-hmm.
Or Working Genius?
Yep.
Okay. So someone in DISC, for instance, who's a high C, who's very detail-oriented, is going to want to do more math. Someone who's a high I, maybe not good at math, maybe doesn't like the numbers. Like, I have had clients where I've just said, you know what? You could do all the math or you could just double your prices and see if that helps. And they do, and it does. So, whoever's listening, take this information through your own filter and do what feels right to you. Take some risks, but, you know, don't insult your soul.
Yeah.
You know, take the information and use it. So I'm fine being the highest person in the market, but if you're a little conservative about it, and, you know, Bob's Plumbing is up here, you could be right here and send Bob flowers. Thank you for just being a premium price provider in our industry. You make it easier for all of us. Thank you. Like, love on that guy as opposed to tear him down. Take him to lunch. What are you doing? How'd your journey go? Were you scared to raise your prices? What made you make the leap? Like, become part of the club that is charging premium prices, because those guys have had a minute. Like, you know, they went through all this stuff, you know, to come to the point where I'm going to charge a premium price and I'm going to do my best to deserve it so I can pay myself well, my team well, do right by the community, take the hit if a job falls apart, you know, survive a tough economic moment. That's what higher prices will do for you. If you can start stockpiling some profits and cash, you're going to do better. In the overall scheme of things, there's three KPIs. There's sales, profits, and cash. Now, when you're just getting started, make a sale, make a crappy sale, do your best, just sell stuff. Really commit to creating a service and sales focused culture. We're going to do right by people and we're going to help them make good decisions on our watch. And then get operationally good enough that you can start making a profit. If you operate too long at a loss, you're going to go into debt and that debt could topple you, because the third KPI, so sales, profits, and then cash, businesses go under or owners start doing hinky things when they run out of cash.
That's right. That is right. They do hinky things. Bad decisions get made.
Brother and sister.
Bad decisions get made. We're kindred. We're kindred spirits.
We are.
Okay, we've talked a bit about like how to get to the price, and there's two routes. There's like one, take the formula that we described and get the spreadsheet and build it out and do version A, version B, version C. Mm-hmm. Ask ChatGPT to do some advanced modeling on it. Like you can nerd out on it, or you can also, if the expedient way, if you're lazy, is just like you can probably also just try doubling it. And I kind of like giving people two options. What I would love for you to speak to, and I think you're uniquely positioned to speak to it because of the scale of the businesses you've run, many, many multiple locations with service providers. So you have, in other words, you have aggregate data. You have a vantage point on this that a small business owner operating in their market, maybe doing 100 jobs a year, maybe 500 jobs a year, wouldn't have. The question is this. When you're trying to work out price sensitivity, a private equity investor, an investor's mind would say, we want to move prices up to the point where the market starts telling us no, Like the, in other words, we're now we've sort of gone past optimal pricing. The market is saying this is too high, and then we ratchet it back and we find this spot between price and value. You can almost think of it like a supply and demand curve from you know, economics 101. We find this spot that is sort of price optimized, and we sit there, and then we stay there for a year. We analyze a year later, a couple years later, or the market changes, whatever. But there's a, you get what I'm saying? There's this meandering way, not even meandering, strategic way to find the price optimal point on the curve. My question for you is, what signals should a small business owner be looking for besides just people saying that's too expensive? Because that's kind of obvious. But what other signals should a business owner be looking for if they're trying to move prices up? If they're really paying attention, what signals are they getting from customers in the market that would suggest, hey, this actually is just a little bit past prime. Let's dial this back 7% and try to find that equilibrium point.
Okay. First off, dear listener, go listen to, is it Adam Coffey who you
have
on?
Yeah, Adam Coffey.
Going to have on?
Yeah.
Because I am not the guy to even care about any of that. Okay. So I just don't go there, because here's what I think. Is that the variables that are happening between the technician and the customer are so much bigger than all of the math you can do on an algorithm like that. So that's what's causing a customer to say he's too expensive. And that's the word, those are the words they use when something went awry. Okay, so what I would say is, I don't know that that's so, that our prices are too high, until we've really dialed down what's happening between the service technician and the customer. So I'm going to brag on ServiceTitan a minute here. And it's happening across the world. At ServiceTitan, they call their artificial intelligence Titan Intelligence. They're listening to calls, and then based on mechanical learning and artificial intelligence, they can tell by the tone and the words where a customer is responding or you're losing them. And you can improve close rate on the front end with your call takers right there. Same with the dispatchers. Now they have Sales Pro. Sales Pro, I would say to the customer, Mrs. Fernwicky, this device, my tablet, will record our conversation. That's for quality assurance purposes and to protect you. May I turn it on? Mm. And they're going to say yes. I'd say yes. It's just the world we live in. Sure. Okay. Now, that records the call. And again, the tonality, the words used. When he said, that way I don't hit you twice on the price, or whatever the guy says or the gal says, there's like a ding on the AI that lets you know that's where the relation, it's getting so sophisticated, your ability. And aside from all that glamorous AI, ride along with your technicians. They'll tell you, oh, the customers are too cheap. Then you ride along with them and they're smoking a cigarette and throwing it down as the customer opens the door. Yeah. They're standing too close. They never ask for the sale. They never shut up. They don't know what they're doing. Like, there'll be so many ways that you could improve that experience. And most of the time, your technicians are deliciously fixable. They just never had anyone coach them before.
So this is a really interesting point that you're making. And I'm glad you sort of take a different approach on this, because it actually makes a lot more sense for our audience who doesn't have 50 locations and a team of controllers and CFOs preparing reports for them every day. These are much more grassroots businesses. And so what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is the place to look for price sensitivity and the place to sort of optimize the ratio is the sales interaction. It is the phone call. It is the hand-to-hand, the one-to-one, you know, over the kitchen counter or on the phone conversation, because it's qualitative data, but you will get the data there. You'll just sense it, that the customer takes a step back or the body language changes, the tonality changes. And if you're paying careful enough attention to that data set, it's quite easy to see where you're too high, where you probably could actually raise things, and then ideally where you're perfect.
Yeah. And I do have access to all those locations, and there's 14,000 Service Titan users, and I still am of this opinion.
Right. Right. So that's
the
place.
I still have all that because I've ridden along maybe 200 times now. And when I ride along, this is not complicated. No one's just shopping for a drain cleaner or a window washer or gutters. They don't want to call you, but they're calling you because they have a problem. They really want you to be the guy.
Right.
Or the gal. They want you to win. They don't want to call eight people. So, like, most of the time when you go on a call and they don't make the call, it's so obvious what happened. If you just watch, it'll make your stomach hurt again. There's a lot of stomach hurting in this business. Just
saying.
But it's all fixable. It's all fixable. It's such a – I love the trades.
So let's talk about this idea of deliciously fixable. I would – there are practical steps that need to be taken to for a business owner if they're still doing sales themselves or a sales team that the business owner leads to gain the confidence needed to what I would call own their price. In other words – put it down, say the number with a straight face, looking them in the eye, and not feel queasy, not feel just sort of like, this is what it costs. That doesn't happen on the first try and isn't going to happen on the first try for a bunch of our listeners if they choose to go down this route. So what kind of, is there stuff that you work on in training rooms with your salespeople? What does the coffee shop meeting after the ride along look like where you're coaching them saying, this is what we need to do? Like, I'm wondering what the actual tactical skill improvement needs to be to get someone to the mental confidence place where they can own their price.
This, let me come back on your show again because I love you so much and I want to dig into this even more, but I'm going to give you some, good nuggets here. Suppose you ride along with someone, resist the urge to tell them the 100 things that they could have done better. Okay, love on them, love on their family, ask them things about their life. Let them know I'm here to make a friend. If there's one tip I could give you today that might make your job easier, do I have your blessing to give it to you? You're like, make a friend. Like this, they're afraid. What are the boss doing? Oh my God, what is he here for? Like that's stressful. Try and tone that down. Like just let's see what's happening. Maybe there's something we're setting you up to fail about. I don't know. Let's find out. So you ride along and you notice that this happens a lot. Two things happen a lot. One is they let the customer diagnose the problem and then start working without doing a thorough diagnosis. So they lose control of their expertise because the customer said they wanted this, whether or not that's in the customer's best interest or not. Like, do a diagnosis and then you're making educated suggestions. So that's one thing that I often see. And the second thing is they don't shut up. They don't ask for the sale and just be quiet for a second. So let's say the first thing is they don't do a diagnosis. You notice that when you're on the ride along. So instead of telling them a million things about booties and this and that and all, just say, can I make one suggestion? Yes. When you get started, we have a little checklist for you when it's a kitchen faucet. Just go through and ask those questions. Or what are three questions you could ask her that would give you a little more information about the faucet? Well, how long have you had the faucet? Do you like the faucet? Sometimes you never ask that. Do you even like this faucet? I hate this faucet. Oh, that's like a good answer. Okay, so you ask a couple questions. Now, when we go on the next call, let's see if he or she can change their behavior in the game. Because if they've gone on 10,000 service calls, that might be pretty ingrained. Practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Okay, so is this person willing and capable of changing their behavior is what I'm looking for. So you go on the next call and he doesn't make the sale, but by God, he does ask a couple questions about the faucet. He has the presence of mind to change his behavior. To me, that's a huge win. Because here's a person who's willing and capable of change. Now we've got a delicious opportunity. Okay, let's do some coaching. Let's go back. Let's role play. Let's go through our 5-step process. Let's make sure we understand it. Let's practice right along with someone who does it well. It's like becoming a good golfer. you're going to do all these things. You're going to watch videos. You're going to hang out with good golfers. You're going to make mistakes, but you're going to keep going and you'll get better. But what you want to ascertain, now, if I go with that guy and he says, you don't understand, it's not me, it's the customer, maybe it's time to move him.
So, Ellen, what I'm hearing you say here, when we talk about really helping our sales teams get the confidence to charge what they charge, or us as owners get the confidence back, there's three things, 2 points you just made. One of them was from earlier in the interview. One is this thing that you do really well with the Zoom Drain people about what our friend Mike Michalowicz calls mission motivation, which is you need to believe that what you do is important in the first place to charge what you need to charge to make what you need to make. So if the fundamental premise of your business is, well, we just mow lawns or I just do plumbing, it's going to be very, very hard to put the number down and own it. So that's the first thing. The second thing you talk about is that diagnosis, or another way people might call that different things, but what it is in the context of a sales call is it's establishing command. Like, whose dojo is this? I realize this is happening at your house, but this sales call is my dojo. And that, now, if you rock up and you say that to a homeowner, you sound like an idiot, but you can subliminally, you can communicate that in stance, posture, tonality, taking the lead of the conversation. Okay, guys, really excited to look at this project with you. The way that we do this is set up, and then sort of execute the flow of steps. That's a huge thing and makes the close, which we'll get to, this is the third point, just ask for the sale, for Pete's sake. Yeah. It doesn't need to be this crazy Grant Cardone close where you have this like long-winded battle where you're negotiating price. All I would ask people to do is go from not asking for the business to asking for the business. And that is an immediate like 10%, 20% boost to sales ratio. You would know better than me. And it gives you the ability to own the price that you need to own. So just anything to layer on there. Those are just some recap points I wanted to make of what you said.
Here's a nuance. I learned this from my buddy, Al Levy. If you haven't had him on your podcast, do it. The 7-Power Contractor.
We have, but we'll have him back.
He's got some very good tools to become better at selling. And he calls his system ethical selling. He's all about helping your customer make a good decision. Love the bit about the dojo, by the way. So one of his recommendations is when you ask, be conscious of the words you're using. Like a closing line or an ask would be something like, how would you like me to get started? Option A or option B? And when you've done that, he suggests you bite the inside of your cheek and just give them a minute, because they're thinking, you're nervous, but they're thinking, I could put it on my Amex. Maybe should I pay cash? Where's my checkbook? Do I have anything on the home? They're just thinking, give them a minute. But the next person to talk should be them, because if they say, okay, let's go, then you say, this is what I always say as a salesperson. Great. You've made a good decision. Here's what happens next.
Perfect.
And then I tell them what happens next and I start making good on the promise. So like that is a skill set to develop, to practice those words, to play with them, to role play, to, you know, do it in safe environments. But now I say those as soon as I know I'm, even if it's like my husband, if I want him to do something, as soon as I know I'm asking, I'm going to shut up. And I will give him choices. Do you want to go out tonight or tomorrow night?
Right.
With my granddaughter, do you want to wear this or do you want to wear this? As opposed to not asking or fighting, just give him some choices that make sense. Both are fine. Either's fine. And then these are skills that can be developed. I know that's a little granular, but no, that's useful information.
I like granular. Listen, 90% of sales, people have sold themselves. And the only thing you need to do to close is part of my French, but not f it up. That's the only, you just have to not intervene. They've already decided they want to buy. And you just have to not screw it up by, in most cases, being silent and letting them say. I mean, my favorite one of all time is, we would really love to do this work with you. In order to move forward and put this on the schedule, we take a small deposit. Is that something we can do today? I mean, that works. That works in every single environment for every industry.
You practice that. Yeah. So this is where, you know, it's okay to practice these words so that you're not stumbling for the first time trying to say it in front of the customer. That's why you said that so nicely. I felt that as a customer and I thought, this guy is, he's in charge. We're making good decisions here. Let's go.
I've done it a few thousand times. So I just, I love those points. Like, believe in the product you're selling. That mission motivation piece is huge. It's your dojo, not theirs, and ask for the sale. A question about price. This is just a practical one given the environment, Ellen. Like, we are in really, let's just say, inflationary times right now. And it's my view that when the cost of everything is going up at a pretty steep rate, for businesses, you can categorize them into two buckets. There are businesses that are really proficient and sophisticated in how they're able to pass along rising costs to the customer, which is how an economy works. There's nothing unethical about that. That's just how capitalism functions. You pass along rising costs to the customer. There's another bucket who get caught holding the bag. So in order to avoid that, is this an annual update? Are you looking at this? Like, what's the cycle? What kind of analysis happens? Do we just arbitrarily add 6% every year? What should a good business owner do to stay on the front edge of this?
Oh, that's such a good question, because what I wouldn't do is some kind of like add on surcharge for disposal,
right?
Or a dingum for using their credit card. Pack it all into the price. Nobody likes small print, and or, you know, well, prices have gone up on materials, so there's a lot. Just don't confuse the issue. Just raise your prices. I'd rather you raise them consistently 6%. Whatever it is, it's probably going to be material that you're talking about. Certainly could be insurance. These are costs we know are going to go up. So as you go through that calculation of what are my costs for doing business, it's going to increase. Now, I would also suggest that you don't have to explain it. Again, just present the prices and options and be quiet and let them bring up, wow, you know, I don't have the money for this. I would definitely have multiple financing options available. Mm-hmm. Even for smaller jobs, credit card, take all the credit cards. We don't take Amex because it's more expensive. The customer pays for everything, build it all in, and make it convenient for them to take anything that they have. Take Venmo, figure out how to do that. I haven't figured out crypto yet, but why not? Like, take everything you can. Make it easy for them to buy from you. But financing, oh, now in ServiceTitan, in the tablet with the customer, the service technician can go over financing options that breaks it down to a monthly payment. Have you noticed Chipotle? If you order Chipotle online, they give you a finance option.
You're
for
kidding.
It.
Oh my God. Is that where we're at as a society, where we're piecemealing the payment for a burrito?
Helping, yeah. But if that's helping your customers, if that's going to make it easier for them to say yes, and certainly for big ticket home repairs or things that they didn't anticipate, that might be the only way that they get to say yes. But how can I say this? Your confidence in your product, in your services, in you. Here's one thing too. When they're comparing you, so suppose a customer says no. Okay, when they say yes, you're going to say, congratulations, you've made a great decision. Here's what happens next. So what if they say, you know, I had another guy come out and his price was a lot less. And maybe then you never did a good job of differentiating yourself in the first place. So it might be a good thing to look back or do a debrief on your performance. But in the moment, you might consider with the customer that, Mrs. Fernwicky, I know you want to get the best value for your dollar and for your experience here. And there are a lot of uncertainties when you're using a contractor. Here's what ABC Plumbing doesn't have. They don't have me. I'm your guy. I'm going to make sure that this job gets done. Your unique selling proposition is always you. It's each technician laying claim to the outcome of this experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do such a great job for you that you're going to want to give me 5-star review. And if you at any point don't feel like I deserve that, you let me know, because I'll get us back on track.
Yeah.
I'm going to take good care of you. The other guys don't have me. That's the difference. That you can sell every day.
That's good swagger. Okay, I have a really out there and fun hypothetical question to ask you as a close. And I'm going to take you. This is like a very visual question. So if you need to close your eyes, close your eyes. Listen, you are a young and growth hungry female entrepreneur in the trades with visions of an 8-figure business one day. This is important. One night, a magic genie wearing Pit Viper sunglasses, jean shorts with no shirt, bright purple Crocs for footwear, and the sexiest mullet you've ever seen. I'm not sure why that's important, by the way. It's just part of the question. So just bear with me.
I got it.
He arrives at your door with bad news. He says, Ellen, I've been asked by your creator to come take away all of your business skills except for two. You can keep two. Which two are you keeping and why?
The ability to make a sale, that I can sell something to somebody. Sales are essential. And the understanding of a balance sheet and profit and loss. So like the financial scorecards, those two things, at the end of the day, then be nice to people.
Right.
Figure out the rest, you know, minute by minute. But I think those are the two essential skills. I think good salespeople can make good business owners, but often they neglect the almost as important skill, maybe as important skill, of you got to keep track of the money. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to do that, don't go into business, dear younger me, mm-hmm. who's in love with the purple crocked guy.
Yeah, he's the
best. If he has a good nickname like Hot Rod, I would have married that guy. So, you know, don't neglect your stewardship.
Yeah.
Being a business owner requires that you figure out the money. It's not an option to say, yeah, I don't do the money. I hire people to do that. It's still your money. It's still your money and your stewardship. And that is something as the owner you have to take on. The good news is it's not that hard. It's easier than all those other skills. It's really one of the easy ones.
It's actually even way easier. It's actually even way easier than the skill or the craft or the trade that you do. Learning how to put together a top line gross profit, overhead net profit equation is orders of magnitude easier than learning to be a plumber. And I think that I really wish people could just accept that fact. What you already know how to do is so much harder than the thing that you're gapped on. So this is like,
there's so much more math.
You're
doing way more math already.
Totally.
Measuring and, you know, all of the physics you got in most of the trades, you don't have to do any of that. Yeah, I don't know how to do any of that stuff. That's the hard stuff.
It's low-hanging fruit. Ellen, you are the best.
Awesome.
I really appreciate you. I'm sure we'll cross paths again soon. Thank you for the time and the wisdom.
You're such a good interviewer. Thanks for being my ally and, you know, playmate in this podcast. I had so much fun today.
Thanks, Ellen. Take care. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.